Hello, welcome everybody. My name is Erin Schaefer. I'm a grad assistant at the Women's Center, and I'd like to welcome you to our Women on Wednesday series, Education, Advocacy, and Empowerment, celebrating 20 years. A few items before we get started. Please turn off any pages or cell phones, and please stay seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speaker. Also, if you could please fill out your orange evaluation sheets, we use this for future programming. Our session today is titled Stay Strong, Play On, Current Issues of Women and Girls in Sport. Today's talk will explore the impact of sports on women and girls and society as a whole, as well as some of the research that has emerged over the last 40 years that has revealed several issues such as sexism and heterosexism. Our speaker today is Dr. Nicole Lavoie. Nicole is the Associate Director for the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport and the co-coordinator of the Minnesota Youth Sport Research Consortium, as well as an instructor in the area of physical activity, social behavior science at the University of Minnesota. We are very grateful to have her here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Nicole Lavoie.
Thanks, Erin. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming out on a Wednesday. Who knows what today is? Okay, you're exempt. Who else knows what is a very important day today? Anyone? Nobody. All right, well, I'll give you the answer. It is the National Girls and Women's Sport Day. It's the 25th annual National Girls and Women's Sport Day. So it's fitting today that our topic and that it falls on Wednesday. So it's fun for me to be here. I'm actually a St. Cloud native. I feel like, I mean, literally my parents' house is literally right across the river from here. You know where the Munsinger Gardens is? I live right there. And so I went to St. Cloud Tech. Any Techsters in here? Tech Tigers? Don't be shy. There we go. All right. And I've taken some classes here, a little post-secondary classes, and took some grad class here. My dad was a professor here for a number of years. He's now retired in communication disorder. So it's fun for me to come back to Minnesota and actually come back to St. Cloud State, and it's fun to be here today. So what our game plan is here then today is we're going to talk about four major areas of research that we have going on in the Tucker Center. For those of you who don't know what the Tucker Center is, there are some brochures and some of our newsletters on the back table. If you're super inspired after what you hear today and you want to be on our mailing list, there's a sign up back there, and I'd be happy to talk to you more about the Tucker Center. It's the one and only of its kind in the whole world. A lot of people don't know that. That's housed at an academic institution and is solely funded and related to studying girls and women in sport. So I will tell you a lot of the stuff that I'll talk about today in terms of trends and barriers of girls' participation in sport and physical activity. We'll talk a little bit about coaches. I see a lot of guys in the room, and I'm really excited about that because oftentimes you think, oh, well, it's the Tucker Center for Girls and Women in Sport. What does this possibly have to do with me if I'm a guy? And so, you know, guys, I know some of you might be sitting there thinking, that, how does she read my mind? That's okay. I get that a lot. But a lot of you will have female significant others or currently do. Some of you will grow up to have, you'll be parents and you'll have daughters. So a lot of these issues that may not seem super relevant to you right at this moment, a couple years from now, down the road, you might, oh, there was, I remember that. And maybe there are some resources out there that can help me. So we'll talk about media, and then we'll talk about heterosexism. And I've left some time at the end for questions. So if you do have questions, please raise your hand. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about some resources. I suppose I got to stay near the mic because we're recording this. I'm used to walking around, so I'll try to behave. So the Minnesota Youth Sport Research Consortium is housed at the University of Minnesota. It's just, I want to just make you aware that it's there. A lot of the work that I do, I'm about 50-50. A lot of my work is gender, girls and women in sport, and the other half is I do a lot of coach and parent education. So those of you in the coaching class here, I teach psychology and coaching at the U, and I'm probably in the community around Minnesota once a week giving a sport parent workshop on helping parents make youth sport a more positive place for kids. In fact, I'm doing one tomorrow down at the U. So just as a resource, if you are interested. This is the Tucker Center website. It's tuckercenter.org. You can see we do a fall and spring distinguished lecture. Our spring lecture has just been announced with Mariah Burton Nelson, who is a very, very well-known, excellent speaker, and she'll be talking on gender, physical activity, and aging. A lot of the work we do at the Tucker Center has been youth-related, so we thought we might do the other end of the spectrum. So it's free and open to the public, much like this. It's on the 21st, and if you would like more info, you can jump on our website. So enough about some websites. If you've noticed on the back table, and I have some down here as well, one of the things that we did at the Tucker Center in late 2007 was put out the Tucker Center Research Report. It was a culmination of all the latest research about adolescent girls and physical activity. We originally put out a report in 1997 that we distributed around the world. Maybe, you know, there was a lot of copies that went out. And so what we found is as the 10-year update came up, people were wondering if we were going to do one, so we did. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about three major trends that we found in that report. And if you want one, there's some in the back, and if you really want one, it's first come, first serve. We'll see who's fast. You can run up here at the end and grab one. And if you don't get one, put your name on the mailing list, and I'll make sure that you put a note. I'd really like one of those reports, or you can download it online for free. There's a full PDF and an executive report. So there's three major trends that we found in physical activity in girls. So the first trend, the good news, being that it's National Girls and Women's Sport Day, come on in, don't be shy, there's some right here in the front. That's what happens when you come in late, you get to sit in the front. Great. So the good news is that we have more girls and women participating in organized sport than ever before, historically. And that's great. Because in 1972, who knows what happened in 1972? Okay, you're exempt again. It's always one in the crowd that has all the answers, all right? So 1972, historic federal legislation, Title IX is passed, which basically catapulted the historic numbers of girls participating in sport. And I was at a breakfast this morning at the boathouse at the U in celebration of today, and our former swim coach, Gene Freeman, who started coaching in 1972, talked about some of the differences between then and now, and if I had time, I'd love to share them with you. It was really interesting. So organized sport more than ever before, whether it's the youth level, the high school level, or even the collegiate level. And that's the great news, because in 1972, about one in every 27 girls played high school sports. One in 27. Today, it's about one in three, 2.5 to 3. So we've made a lot of progress in the last 35 years, and that's good. So let me just let's have everybody who played high school athletics just stand up. Hey, it's good to know who my jocks are in the audience. That's good. All right, you guys can sit down. All right, so what we know, though, is even though we have historic numbers of girls participating in sport, only one in three girls gets enough physical activity to meet the guidelines to accrue health and developmental benefits. So we know when girls participate in sport, and boys too, that there are a lot of health benefits, there are a lot of developmental benefits, social, psychological, emotional, maybe moral development, depending on who's your coach. But one in three girls get enough physical activity to have the positive benefits. The second third is barely getting enough to meet health benefits. And the third then, the third is completely sedentary. And those of you who are studying perhaps kinesiology or sport management know, or you're reading the public press, is that childhood obesity is a national health epidemic. So we want kids to be physically active. But most kids right now are not getting enough physical activity. Now, the second trend then is, remember, it's organized sport. Girls in organized sport more than ever before. Record numbers bursting at the seams. And who knows what the fastest growing sport in the U.S. is? Shout it out.
Soccer.
It is not soccer. That's a good guess. It used to be soccer.
Lacrosse.
Any lacrosse players in here? One, right? Maybe two. Okay. And we need coaches. There's very few lacrosse coaches because it's growing so much. So second trend is that outside of organized sport, in physical education, only 1 in 3 girls get daily physical education in the schools. And you may or may not know, but there's no federal requirement right now for physical education in the schools. In fact, with budget cuts and the economic crisis, physical education is one of the first things to go. So a lot of girls are not getting any physical activity in the schools. Now, when they are getting physical education in the schools, when they're in class, they're less active and move with less intensity than the boys. And I love this picture because a lot of people have varying experience in physical education. Some people loved it, and those are typically the people that might have stood up, the athletes, we call you the motor elite, the people that were actually pretty skilled. If you weren't and you're the last picked or you didn't have physical skills, physical education might not have been a very good experience for you. So, it's not good that girls are not getting physical activity in the schools. And we know that the gap, as girls get older, and this is true for boys, but the gap gets bigger. So as girls get older, they become less active. It's true for boys, but the gap gets bigger. And we know that girls of color, this gap of inactivity, gets wider for girls of color. Now, why is it important that people are physically active, right? Well, because it's good for health. So we have a lot of health disparities as well between men and women, boys and girls, because of the lack of physical activity. And we know the gap is bigger for girls of color. The gap is also greater for girls that have cognitive or physical impairments or immigrant girls. We have a lot of immigrant populations in St. Cloud and the Twin City metro area, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the research in that area. So we've got organized sport more than ever before in the schools, not as active, and the gap widens. And the third trend then is that, well, not this gap, but there is a gap that in whatever context you're in, whether it's physical activity or organized sport, boys always outnumber the females in terms of participation numbers. And this is some data from the National Federation of High Schools that's down in Indianapolis. And I've seen their most recent data, and it hasn't changed much. So boy athletes, male athletes, outnumber girls about 5-3. Now, the other stats on this is that we know girls also drop out of sports at earlier numbers than boys and in greater numbers. So not only do we have a gendered participation gap, but right around adolescence, the critical developmental period where we want everybody to be physically active for health and developmental benefits, girls are dropping out of sport almost at a 3-1 pace to boys. So what is going on with this? I mean, these are some really compelling data around trends in physical activity, and there is a huge gendered gap. Well, I get asked this question a lot, and the answer is that there are barriers to sport participation and physical activity for boys and girls, but there are more barriers for girls. And this is, the research tells us this over and over again. Now, the barriers are complex, and I could spend at least 1 hour just on this slide alone articulating the many different barriers that girls face to physical activity. So in summary, I'll just say it can be choice. I don't want to play sport. Okay, it could be an individual choice, but our individual choices are often shaped by the environment and the people and the society around us. So it's not usually just an issue of individual choice. It could be the family. Sport is not valued in that family. You have other obligations in terms of caring for siblings or working. It might be adult leaders. You have had bad experience with coaches that are undertrained or create a bad environment. It's not fun, so you quit. Or they're not caring, they're not competent. It could be a lack of community programming. Maybe it's that sport that you like, maybe it's lacrosse. There's no lacrosse team. Now what do you do? I mean, when I moved to St. Cloud in 1978-79, I played soccer. I grew up in Missouri. They had a very well-oiled machine in terms of soccer league, even when I was little. I moved to St. Cloud. There was no soccer in St. Cloud, 1978. Zero. So I thought, well, now what am I going to do? Well, if you've been across the river, if you go on, it's now University Drive, right? They renamed it. University Drive. What is on the right-hand side immediately after you cross the river? Frisbee golf, right? And what else? There's some tennis courts. So that's right across the street from my house. I'm like, well, I'll play tennis. Worked out pretty well for me that I played a lot of tennis growing up. I played collegiate tennis at Gustavus, went on to coach tennis for about 17 years prior to coming into academia. So that worked out pretty well. But if you can't afford the programming, you don't have access to the programming, you may not participate. And I'll talk about societal stereotypes, about the construction of gender and what it means to be a girl in our society is often in opposition to what it means to be an athlete. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go. So one of the research projects that we have going on in the Tucker Center, myself and one of my graduate students, Chelsea Thule, is looking at East African girls. We have the largest population of East African immigrants in the country in the Twin City metro area. And I know there are quite a few East African families that live up here in St. Cloud metro area as well. And these girls face a great number of barriers due to cultural and religious traditions that they want to maintain, but they also want to be physically active. So we've been talking to them about these barriers, and they talk about it has to be female only because they can't exercise with males present. It's against their religious tradition. It has to be safe. Okay, they have to be covered. So if you imagine, those of you, whatever sport, if you had to wear a full dress and a head covering, which they call a hijab, or some people call it a headscarf, that may not be comfortable to participate, but you might still want to do it. But I just read an article recently that, where was it? I think it was in France, but this has happened in the U.S. too, is that a Muslim woman wants to participate in a soccer league, and they say, no, it's dangerous, you can't do that, and so she's not allowed to play. So when are we going to have policies in place that make it inclusive for a wide range of participants to be active if they want to be? And then they talk about good coaches, is that there are a lot of coaches that don't understand their cultural traditions, they don't care about the girls, and they make them feel like they shouldn't be there. So we're really working very closely with this community to ensure that East African girls have the space to be active if they want to be. And I can assure you, they want to be physically active. Okay, so this is a picture of a soccer team actually in St. Paul. There's a club called the Blackhawks that is very culturally inclusive, and you can see there's a variety of different girls from Hmong to Somali to other East African countries that play in this club. So what we really want then in the Tucker Center is to argue that we want physical activity across the lifespan, from kids to childhood to high school to college, even into old age, because we have to ensure people are physically active so they remain healthy participants. This is true for men too, right? So that's our first area of research that we do in the Tucker Center. All right, so let's talk about female coaches. How many of you are currently coaching or aspire to coach? Raise your hand. Okay, good. All right, I want all the guys to stand up. Now I'm going to say a sentence, and if this is true for you, you can sit down. Okay? So if this is true for you, you could just sit. I have had, at some time in my life, a female coach. Okay, that's four. I saw four sit. Okay, guys, you can sit down. Okay, women, let's have you stand up. Okay. Same question. At any point in my physical education, sport participation, I have never had a female coach. If you've never had a female coach, sit down. Interesting. That's good. Usually I have a couple of people sit down. Okay, you guys can sit. All right, so what we know, there's some data I'll share with you here, is that, I said, girls' participation is at an all-time high, but the number of female coaches is at an all-time low. So why is that? We have more girls participating than ever before. They should be funneling up. We should have lots of coaches, women coaching, but that's not the case. So 1972, when Title IX was passed, 90% of college female athletes were coached by women. What do you think the number is today? I said we've gone backwards, so you know it's less than 90.
40.
We got a 40, okay. 10. Okay. Any other guesses?
15.
15. It's like Price is Right, okay. 16, 17, what's the highest bidder? 43. 43%. It's pretty good. Must be because you play lacrosse. Smart guys play lacrosse. Yeah. All right, so here's the graph. If you want this data, you can go online. Acosta and Carpenter have been looking at this longitudinal data since the early 70s. And this is what it looks like. So what happened? And this is at the collegiate level. Is it any different at the high school and the youth level? Do you think it's gotten worse or has it gotten better? Well, I've been looking. So here's a graph of different levels of women in sport from the WNBA to D1, D3, D2, and I have some data here in Minnesota. So that red line is 50%. So even if you wanted to see half the coaches coaching girls be females, we're not even close. And why does it matter, right? Is it important that girls and women are coached by women? I'm not saying men aren't great coaches or competent coaches, but if we have 50% at least of women coaching girls, that would be good. And 50% of women coaching men would be great too. But I'd bet the farm and every possession I own that will never happen in my lifetime, unfortunately. About 2% of all men's teams, whether that's collegiate, high school, or even the youth level, are coached by women. 2%. And that number has remained remarkably stable since 1972. So the number of women coaches for girls have gone down, and the number of women coaching boys and men has remained remarkably low. So what's going on in Minnesota? According to the Minnesota State High School Coaches Association, who I work with quite closely, 17% of all coaches of boys and girls in high school sport are coached by women. And it's about 2% of women coach boys, and about 43% of female athletes are coached by women. So not drastically different. I do a lot of work with the Minnesota Youth Soccer Association. And you can see here, you've got three positions. The head coach was just the red line. So as the kids get older, from U9 to U19, the number of female coaches goes down. But we most often see women in the team manager position. So if you ever want to read a great book by a wonderful sports sociologist by Mike Messner, it's called All for the Kids, Gender, Family, and Youth Sports. He talks about how youth sport reproduces traditional gender roles that we see in the workplace. So we see mostly men in the most prevalent positions of power, the head coach, which you could argue is kind of the most important position of power, and we see a lot of women in the team manager, which is often called the team mom. So again, it reproduces gendered stereotypes about women in leadership. So we see a lot of this in youth sport, the soccer moms, the moms providing what we call logistical support, driving the van, making the snacks, washing the uniforms, and the fathers and men are typically coaching. And unfortunately, these patterns are still fairly true today. So we see a lot of this, men coaching girls. We see a little bit of this, women coaching kids. Not a lot, but we see some. And we rarely see women coaching older boys. So when we do see women coaches, it's at the less competitive levels or the younger age groups. So why is that? There's a lot of reasons why the research says. So some of the same barriers that we talked about earlier. So why does it matter? Do we care? So what? There's less female coaches. I don't care. Maybe it doesn't matter to you. But I can tell you it does matter to a lot of people, myself included. And I can tell you that girls need visible and active female role models. We're going to talk about media representations in a minute. So you don't see women, active female role models in the media very often. They need them. And in order to do that, they have to be visible. They have to be out in the community, at least in equal numbers. If we want to challenge outdated gender stereotypes about women in society and women in leadership roles, we have to see women in positions of power that people care about. And a lot of people care about sport. What better way to challenge stereotypes? And the other thing is that when women are the minority in any context, whether it be corporate America or sport or the classroom, they experience a lot of sexism and discrimination. So a lot of women that are coaching say, you know what, I'm getting out of here. This is not a really pleasant environment to work in. And one of my current lines of research right now is talking to women that are coaching and uncovering kind of the overt and mostly subtle and covert sexism that women experience while they coach. Like, for instance, it would look something like this. So I walk in to the gym, and I have a male assistant coach, basketball coach. We walk into the gym, and the opposing coach is a male, and he walks right up to my assistant and thinks that he's the head coach. Because he's assuming that, of course, the male would be the head coach, and you're the assistant. That's a form, a very subtle form of sexism that a lot of female coaches. Another one said her male opposing coach came down the basketball sideline during the game and put his hand on her shoulder, around her shoulder, and said, you know, why don't you teach your team to play some real basketball out here? And walked away. What does that mean? What is real basketball? And would he ever do that to a male colleague? No. I would, again, if I had a farm, I'd bet the farm on that would never happen. Okay? So one of the initiatives we have at the Tucker Center, it's called We Coach, Educating and Empowering Through Sport. This is an educational seminar series delivered by female coaches for female coaches. it's a chance for us to network and support one another and also kind of provide some tools to buffer against the kind of hostile climate that can happen out there in coaching. All right, so we want to see more of this. And this is actually, this woman coaches down in Prior Lake in the Prior Lake Soccer Club down there. All right, so let's talk about media representations in our last 10 minutes here. So we don't see female coaches very often. How many people get ESPN magazine? Anyone? A few? Remember this cover? It was the body issue. This was one of, I think, 8 covers. Serena Williams. Serena's always in the news. I mean, those of us at the Tucker Center, and I have a blog. I'm always blogging something about Serena. You know, this Australian Open, right? We're talking about the color of her underwear. I mean, really? It's flesh-colored. So what? You know, there are pictures on the internet. We're not talking about the color of Federer's boxer shorts. Right? Why is this international news? I mean, I'm a tennis player. I've worn tennis underwear. They're usually white. Sometimes they're not. It doesn't make the news. Who cares? Right? But when an African American wears, you know, I'm white. I wear white tennis underwear. Nobody thinks twice. She's African American. She wears tennis underwear that are flesh color for her. And all of a sudden it's media. Isn't that interesting? I think it's interesting. Maybe you don't, but okay, so there's 2 major trends in media coverage of female athletes. The first one is that women athletes, female athletes, get 6 to 8 of the total coverage of sport media. Now, it doesn't matter if it's print media, social media, broadcast media, ESPN, whatever it is, this is a very consistent statistic over the last 2 decades. It hasn't changed. Now, that's also interesting, being that we have more girls and women participating than ever before. So we're almost to the Olympics, so pay attention to this. Who do you think you're going to see the most of in terms of female athletes, female Olympians in the Vancouver Olympics? Who's going to be the poster girl? Lindsey Vonn. Why is that? She's a pretty good skier, for one, which helps. But she's also a woman that is indicative of what we would describe as feminine and attractive according to what's normative in our society. So the fact that she's blonde and pretty and tall is also helps. You're going to see a lot of Lindsey Vonn. In fact, she's on the cover of Sports Illustrated right now. So that's the first trend, 6 to 8%. The second trend is that when we do see women in that 6 to 8%, they're often portrayed in ways that highlight their femininity and their sexuality. And I'm going to show you some examples. So remember, we don't see them very often, but when we do see them, they're in ways that reinforce traditional gender roles about femininity. I'm sexy, I'm pretty, I'm heterosexual. All right? So we have thousands of images that I pulled out, some of my favorites. So Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year, who is this? Michael Jordan. Okay? Let's look at the female sportswoman of the year in Sports Illustrated. This is how she's portrayed. Who is this? What sport is it? No. This is Steffi Graf. Kind of a good tennis player. Sportswoman of the year, late 80s. She's at her peak. This is not Pool and Patio magazine. Okay, she's the best tennis player in the world. This is how she's portrayed. So when I show you these images, those of us who study female in the sport media look for 3 things. Are they in their uniform? Are they on the court, whatever that surface may be? And are they in action? In uniform, on the court, in action. So we've got 0 for 3. 3 for 3. This portrays a very different image of athletic competence than this. Sports Illustrated. So remember, women rarely are on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Over time, over the last 40 years, they're typically on the cover 4% of the time. So that's 2 to 3 covers a year out of 54 covers. And when they are on the cover, they're usually portrayed in ways that highlight femininity. Anna Kournikova, Jenny Finch. 2007, how many covers do you think had women?
4.
Out of 4? 1. Which one was it? The swimsuit issue. Good, all right. Smart crowd. This is 1. Lady Vols won the national championship, Candace Parker, and 2. Now, I don't have anything against Beyonce, but I don't think we'd cast her as an athlete. Okay? So, 3.6%. 2008, 3 of 73. They have special ones, too. So, Danica Patrick, swimsuit issue, and the Lady Vols again. Now, again, I could spend a whole hour on Danica Patrick, but we won't. I'm just going to stop there. All right. Dara Torres, right? Pretty good swimmer, lots of gold medals. If you Google Dara Torres, you will see these images first, okay? And her milk ad. She's kind of in her uniform, although I didn't see her wearing that at the Olympics, so you could argue. I had to scroll down to the fourth page of Google Images to find something that looked like an athletic image of Dara Torres. ESPN, the magazine, another interesting media outlet. 5 covers in 5 years. 5! That's just 1 a year. And look, when they are pictured, feminine, pretty, in the uniform, in action, on the court. No. So why is that? We see a lot. So they're more than likely portrayed this way rather than competent, athletic female athletes, which then reinforces gender stereotypes about skill and ability and athleticism. Media guides, college media guides, most of them are online now, but we've been looking at them for 25 years. So, again, in uniform, on the court, in action, men's basketball team, Ole Miss, 1989. Here's the women's basketball team. You ready? And next. So on the court, and we've got, so this shows just on the court is that men are more likely to be on the court, and this is true, men are more likely to be in action and in the uniform. Over time, now in the 2004 sample, women are pictured more on the court in their uniforms and in action. So there is change, and you can see this. This is Duke women's basketball across time. So by the time we get to 2004, we're seeing a difference. So this is good. But there's still a lot of nonsense out there that I could, again, show you many examples of. So those of you in sport marketing, sport media, we want to see the women in action, in the uniform, on the court. Period. So why is this important? We'll wrap this up. Is that when girls and boys continually see images of women in the media that highlight femininity and sexuality, girls internalize that. And they start thinking that, hey, it's more important of what I look like than what my body can do. It can lead to depression, self-esteem issues, eating disorders, I don't want to participate in sport, etc. And then boys internalize the same images and have idealized and unrealistic portrayals of what females should look like. So this is very dangerous for many, many reasons. And this APA Task Force report is coming out in book form in 2010. A colleague of mine and I have a chapter in there about this issue that will be all the research. So I think we've talked enough about heterosexism. I have some other slides I can show you, but I want to wrap it up so we can leave some time for questions. So the women's hockey team, women's Olympic hockey team, who went to any of the games when they have been playing? Anybody? Nobody? Okay. So this was a program, but on the inside of the program was a profile that looked like this of all the players. Out of uniform, off the ice, not in action. There was one picture of a female hockey player in the uniform in action in the entire 64-page program. These are the best hockey players in the world. And in fact, we see a lot of images of families. I'm a mother. I'm cute. I'm sexy. I'm pretty. I wear high heels, etc. that reinforce heterosexuality. And we could talk about the role of homophobia in women's sport again for another couple hours. So these images here. Okay? The last thing, we have a we're looking at online coaching biographies. So if you go on and you look at, I don't know, what's the name of one of the coaches up here? Shout it out. Anyone? Lori Fisher. She's a women's basketball coach, right? Former coach? Current. Okay. She's still got her job. All right, good. So, you know, you go on the online coaching bios, right, and it's like, oh, Lori Fisher, she grew up in Annandale, and she played here, and she's coached ex-All-Americans, and here's her record, and blah, 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 and she lives in St. Cloud, right? Or it might say, or she's married to so-and-so, and they have a cat, and three children, they live in X, right? Always at the very end. So we've been looking at coaching biographies to see if we can see a narrative of sexual diversity. Okay, so would we see any biographies as, oh, you know, Lori Fisher, she lives in Sartell with her partner Kate, and they have a dog and a cat and a son named Tyler. Would we see that? Right? So we looked across the country at 2,000 coaching biographies, D1, D3, all sports, men and women teams. How many out of 2,000 do you think had a same-sex partner explicitly mentioned in the coaching biography online? Who says zero? Who says more than 10?
Three,
okay. So not many. Two. Now, I can assure you, and I'm, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but I can assure you there's more than two gay coaches in men's and women's athletics across the country. So what we see then is a complete erasure of different types of sexual orientations, different types of families. We saw a lot of heterosexual families mentioned, and opposite sex partners, two. One male coach and one female coach. And they were both in the Division I level, which kind of surprised us. So what we want to argue for is either nobody's personal information should be online or everybody's. Because you're privileging certain orientations over others. And that's not good if we're trying to create a climate of inclusivity and tolerance. Okay. So we've talked about a lot. We could talk about a lot more. So we know there are links between a lot of this and sexism and discrimination and homophobia. So what we're trying to do at the Tucker Center which is definitely a work in progress, is to break that link. Got our work cut out for us. So I'll stop there, and we'll take any kinds of questions you have. And I'm told I'm supposed to repeat them into the microphone. So who has a question? Yep, Aaron. A great question. So the question was, have there been female athletes that have actively protested saying, I want to be in my uniform, in action, on the cover of Sports Illustrated, rather than gazing vacuously on top of a pillow like Anna Kournikova was? We don't know. That's a study we'd really like to do, because we want to study female athletes as active agents. So do they think about this? Should they think about it? You know, if they're on the cover of Sports Illustrated, I'll pay you $10,000 to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Well, I'd like to be in my uniform and in action. Well, I'm sorry, we'll find someone else. So we don't know. And I think that there's a trend now where female athletes are just happy when they get any kind of coverage, that they don't think about how the portrayals in a big picture sense affect young girls and gender stereotypes. But we need, that's some work we need to do. Yes? That's a great question. And so why are you asking that question? Good question. So the question was, what's the demographic breakdown of the subscribers of Sports Illustrated or ESPN? Well, I can tell you that most of the subscriptions are male, and they're catering to a male audience, right? So the argument would be, one, males don't care about female athletes. I don't want to see a female. I'm your target market. Don't put Candace Parker on the cover. I don't care. Two, that when we want to see female athletes, we want to see them looking cute and pretty and feminine. And if we don't, then we're really not interested, right? So there's this idea then that sex sells. Sex sells women's sport. So if I'm going to see a female athlete, show me a little sex, right? And then I might be interested. Now, what I can tell you from some research that two colleagues of mine have done at the Tucker Center is we had focus groups of men, women, of all different ages, and we showed them images, some of these images I've showed you, because we wanted to know, does sex sell or not? If you see sexy Maria Sharapova on the cover of Sports Illustrated as a young male, do you go, oh my God, I would like to fly to New York City and watch her play in the U.S. Open. I'm going to subscribe to Tennis Magazine. I'm going to buy the Tennis Channel on my cable package. No. What we found is that if we go with the argument that sex sells, sex doesn't sell women's sport. Because the market that wants to watch women's sport are not males ages 24 to 35. They don't care about women's sport. So you're marketing a product to a segment that doesn't care. And you're ticking off your market that does care about female athletics. So it's a really good question. Does sex sell? And Dr. Kane, who's the director of the Tucker Center, has a great quote. Sex sells sex. Sex does not sell women's sport. So stop showing female athletes in sexy feminine poses. It doesn't work. Yes?
My argument would be I would buy Sports Illustrated if women were in it.
Right.
I mean, the other thing is I just keep going, how do they know what the market is? Actually, my younger son gets Sports Illustrated.
Right.
And I look at it and just go, there's nothing
in here. Nothing in here for me. Right. Yeah. So the comment is, if Sports Illustrated had legitimate profiles and stories about female athletes, you might pick it up. I would too. And they thought that might work, so they had Sports Illustrated for Women for a while, which tanked because it was a glorified Shape magazine or Cosmo, a sporty Cosmo, and that didn't work. So yes, it's chicken or the egg, right? So if we don't see it in Sports Illustrated, we don't value it. But if so, we don't buy, women don't buy the magazine, so they say women aren't interested in sports. So we're not going to put female athletes in the magazine. So it's a chick, it's this vicious cycle. We need someone at ESPN or Sports to say, that's it. It's a policy decision. Half of our content is devoted to female athletes. Other questions? No? Okay. Oh, yes.
Kind of moving on, idolizing the aesthetically pleasing athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that's kind of just as bad, I'll say, for the men's side too? I mean, aside from like the Manning brothers, and I mean, I would say they target male athletes that are better looking just as much as they do women. I'm not saying it's pro, but I'm saying it kind of goes with both sides. It's just like you're saying with mm-hmm. putting people on the cover of the magazine. What they say, Reggie Bush on the cover of a magazine with the shirt off, greased up, was that dude playing football?
That's a great point. And I'm not saying that we don't see male athletes in sexualized poses, you know, shirts off, biceps and pecs bulging, misted with water, or, you know, greased up, as you say. Sure, we see that. But the argument is, and you're completely right, we are seeing, in fact, we're seeing an increased sexualizing of male athletes, too. So is that equality? I mean, I don't think so. But the argument is that, yes, we see male athletes sexualized, but proportionally, because we see men in 92% of the sport media, proportionally, when you see male and female athletes, you're more often going to see female athletes being sexualized in greater proportion than male athletes. Not that men aren't sexualized. So that's a really good point.
We are officially out of time, but can you stay for a little while?
Of course. If you have questions, if you want reports, I don't want to take these back to Minneapolis, so come grab one if you're interested, and thank you. Thank you.